Hello, welcome to Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Strugini. We're in the book of Genesis, chapter 25, verse 1. Then again Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And she bare him Zimran, and Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shua. And Jokshan begat Sheba, and Dedan, and the sons of Dedan were Asherim, and Letushim, and Leumim, and the sons of Midian, Ephah, and Epher, and Hanok, and Abida, and Elda. All these were the children of Keturah. So as I've mentioned on a number of occasions in a number of different studies, Abraham had a second wife after the death of Sarah, Keturah, and by her he had other sons. And it goes to the point that Abraham's seed, in terms of the promise, is not just anyone who descends from Abraham. This is not just a racial or family blessing. It is a spiritual blessing given from God based on the promise to make Abraham father of many nations, but also that out of him ultimately would come a seed through whom all the nations of the world would be blessed. And in Christianity, we understand this to be Christ. He is the ultimate fulfillment of the promise made to Abraham. And through faith in him, we can all become the children of Abraham because he is that seed. And if he is the seed implanted in us, it is like the promise of God implanted in Abraham, which Abraham believed and through which it was imputed to him for righteousness. So these are the other children. We already knew of Ishmael, and Ishmael looms large in the New Testament in terms of analogies to the law. But Keturah also had children, and many of them come up in the history of Israel later on, such as Midian and Medan, Sheba and Dedan. Many of the other names are unknown beyond this. I haven't done an exhaustive study of where all these nations ended up, and so that's something that, you know, if you're interested in, you'd have to do a study on your own. Verse 5, and Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac. But unto the sons of the concubines, which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son, while he yet lived, eastward unto the east country. So while Abraham was still alive, his other sons, through Keturah, and through and they're potentially other sons through concubines. And you might say, well, I thought Abraham was a righteous man. Abraham believed God, and it was imputed to him for righteousness. I would never speak against Abraham in large. So many times, it's so easy to just pick on a man in his faults and say, well, how could he be a righteous man? He has this fault. There is not a just man on the earth who doeth good and sinneth not. That's either in the Proverbs or Ecclesiastes. There is always a measure of grace. When God looks at a man and declares him righteous, he's looking over our past, you know? Like in Ezekiel where it says, you know, if a man who's he's wicked and he turns from his wickedness, the Lord will forget the wickedness that he had done. That is not to say that there may not be a price to pay. I may still have to pay for that sin with my life. Blood for blood, you know? But that is not to say that the forgiveness of God cannot extend even to murderers. And some people would have trouble with that. But why should God forgive any sin? Well, because it's not so big. Well, God's perfect. And every fault of man can be insidious in its own right. You know, lies can be as murderous as murder itself. You know, like when companies lie about the safety of their products, it can lead to deaths. You know, lust, betrayal, backbiting, all the things, you know, the New Testament is really good about cornering sins that were not generally reckoned in the law. I mean, I just did Galatians chapter 5, the works of the flesh. These things are not necessarily codified in law. Yeah, it says thou shalt not covet your neighbor's wife. But you can adhere to the letter of the law and still be full of lasciviousness, of unbridled lust. Just depending on how you reckon it in yourself. Men are always justifying themselves, minimizing their own sins, and looking on the actions of others, and trying to, you know, measure themselves over others. So I'm more righteous than you are. I'm not as sinful as you are. Or as the prophet Isaiah said, I am holier than thou. Stand by yourself. Come not near to me. You stand alone. Your sins are much worse than mine. We don't do that sleeping with concubines thing in our day and age. No, no. We just kill babies in the womb. That's what we do. And that's good. That's justified. But that you would bring down the righteousness of a patriarch based on something that in his society was acceptable. And he, it's not like he was just mistreating them. Or it's no statement of any such thing. So, well, it's indefensible. Whatever. You know, you moral absolutist. If you're going to be morally absolute, you're going to be condemned. God is allowed to be morally absolute. And God is allowed to use grace to forgive and to overlook. And without grace, none of us can be saved. None of us. Verse 7. And these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived, and 103 score and 15 years. Then Abraham gave up the ghost and died, in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. You may not realize this, but in the Hebrew here, the term gave up the ghost is actually just one word. It means to breathe out. Or in English, we have the idiom to expire. It means to exhale. He exhaled and died. So it's kind of an idiom. Exhalation refers to death. Now, just for this study, I did not go about and look if there are any places where it specifically says gave up the ghost. I know when Jesus died, he said, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. And he gave up the ghost. I'm not sure exactly what the wording there is in Greek. And I'm not going to look it up now. But I've often viewed that and this as really evidence for the thought that in the Bible, the view of death is that when you die, you give up the vital element. You give it up. Jesus gave up the spirit, the ghost, as it's called. You know, it's not a great translation, I suppose, because we think of a ghost as being woo, but it means the spirit, the spirit of life that is in us, that which God breathed into Adam's nostrils goes out, and the man dies. Because it never says things like, and Abraham exited his body and went to heaven. You know, because that's what we believe, many of us. I don't. But many Christians believe that when you die, you, the vital thing that is you, they believe that that life, the spirit of life, is you. That it does not merely animate you. You know, God formed man and breathed into man life. Some people think that that life is man. And I disagree. I think that that man is the interaction of that divine breath with the carnal thing. I mean, the interaction of the breath with me. And it's no more literally breath than it is literally a ghost. Yeah, I mean, it's that animating thing. Yes, we breathe. Breathing is like the sign of life, right? When we check for breathing, is he breathing? Is he alive? So the breath is closely associated with the life. The life comes from God, the living essence of what makes us alive. We can't just manufacture in a laboratory. Not saying it's impossible, but we can't anyways, right? So that living essence is not us. I believe that's what the Bible teaches, that that essence is not us, and that when we die, that returns to he who gave it. We give it up. Abraham was, you know, he died, and he was gathered to his people. That means he was buried. That's what that idiom means. It doesn't mean the angels came down and took him up, though you could interpret it that way. You know, I see the argument for that, I suppose. But in 10, Well, I'm getting ahead, wasn't I? He died in a good old age, full of years, and was gathered to his people. He was 175. And his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, which is before Mamre, the field which Abraham purchased of the sons of Heth. There was Abraham buried. And Sarah, his wife, they don't usually say, there was Abraham's body laid to rest, but of course he wasn't there. I'm just saying, that's not the way, it's so easy to sort of look at the body and sort of say, oh, it's nothing, it's just this carnal thing, and it doesn't matter, and it's going to be turned to dust, it turns into a skeleton, and then it rots away, and it's gone. We are intimately connected to our bodies. Our bodies are how we come to be human. You know, the spirit of life enters into us, and that's what makes us, and it enters into a body, which is a man. And that's what makes us, and that body was created in God's image, and we are animated into life through that spirit. But to say that the spirit is us and we can just leave the body behind and be whole without it, I think is incorrect. That without a body, man is not man and we are not whole. And then when the spirit is ripped from us, it doesn't mean we go out of existence or whatever, but it's like God remembers us. You know, is that spirit that returns to God, is it the conscious essence of a man? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think it's consciously the man. I don't think it is. We are present in that spirit. It's on loan from God. But God can return the life. He can give us our lives back. Because I do think they become personal. Kind of like clothing. You wear a life for a while, it becomes, you feel like it's your life. God looks at it differently. He thinks it's his life. And he takes it back. He knows it's his life. If we want to keep it, he has to give it to us permanently. That's eternal life. Anyways, that's how I view this subject. You know, people don't agree with me very often, and that's all right. You know, they get more upset than I do, you know, and that's all right. I pray the Lord will bring us all to a better understanding of how these things work. But, you know, the understanding of how that works is not absolutely necessary, though I think philosophically it is very beneficial to understand and have the proper view of death and not the traditional view, which I think is more mythological than it is biblical. So Isaac and Ishmael bury Abraham in the cave that he had purchased. Remember that from a few chapters back? When Sarah died, he had to buy the land to bury her. Back in chapter 23, verse 11. And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt by the well, Lahai-Roi. We see Isaac and Ishmael very close together here. You know, one time, Abraham sent Hagar and Ishmael away, and the Lord spared her life, and it was at this very same Lahai-Roi. It was Beer Lahai-Roi several chapters back, 16 precisely, chapter 16, where Hagar despaired, and then she discovered that God did hear, or God sees me. God sees me. He sees me, I believe was the idea behind that. But you can check that study and perhaps have a better memory than I do. Anyways, so Abraham has died. He has left everything he had to Isaac, other than, of course, the gifts he gave and to his other sons whom he sent away, but not empty-handed. I mean, he did not just, you know, treat those children as, you know, full rejects or anything. He gave them gifts and sent them away, but his heir was Isaac. He was heir not only of all Abraham's possessions, but also of all the promises of God, which God had made to Abraham. Verse 12. Now these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's handmaid, bare unto Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names according to their generations, the firstborn of Ishmael, Nebaioth, and Kedar, and Adbeel, and Mibsam, and Mishma, and Duma, and Massah, and Hadar, and Tema, and Jektur, and Naphish, and Kedema. 16. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their towns and by their castles or fortresses. 12 princes according to their nations. So there are 12 princes according to the nations of the sons of Ishmael. He had 12 sons, much as Jacob, who we haven't met yet, but who, if you know anything about the Bible, you are familiar with Jacob, and his name was changed by God to Israel, and we'll learn about that and why. He had the 12 tribes, the 12 sons. But we see that Ishmael also has 12 sons and has 12 tribes, 12 nations come out of him. It was the son that Abraham tried to have outside God's promises because of Sarah's impatience. God blessed him, but he was not the promised seed. And honestly, that could be said of really of every descendant of Abraham. You know, Isaac received the promise, but he was ultimately not the promised seed. I mean, he was the promised seed to Abraham, but when he came into his own, it was not he who would bless all the nations of the world. Then came Jacob. Oh, well, let's learn about Jacob, okay. Verse 17. And these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he gave up the ghost and died and was gathered unto his people. And they dwelt from Havilah unto Shur, that is before Egypt, as thou goest toward Assyria, and he died in the presence of all his brethren. That's the end of Ishmael, though his descendants will play a role in the stories to come. Verse 19. These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister to Laban, the Syrian. 21. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said unto her, "Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." So, we're learning about Isaac now. You know, we heard about his marriage. We heard about how Abraham sent his servant to find Rebekah. And now we learn more details. He was 40 when this happened. So, obviously, that's a late start. At least, by the time I was 40, I'd been well underway. Depending on how old she was, it may explain why she was not having any children. But in any case, Isaac entreated the Lord. She was barren. She wasn't having children. And so she conceived. Much simpler than when it was with Sarah, where God approached Abraham and made him a promise, where they had pretty much figured, well, you know, she was barren and now she's old. Rebekah isn't old. In the time of Israel, 40 was considered the age when you were kind of you were ready to go to war. You were of an age to go to battle. The men younger than that were still seen somewhat as not fully mature. And there's great truth in that. He was 40 years old. So you know he's established. You know, he has established himself. Yeah, he had a head start with Abraham's wealth. You know, he may have had Abraham's wealth when Abraham died. And remember, he married Rebekah before Abraham died. He may have had this wealth coming to him. But you know, people often say, you know, oh, well, they started off with money, so it's so easy. It's not so. A lot of people start off with money and they lose it real fast. You know, it's easy to, you have money, there's a lot of things to spend it on. You can buy a lot of stuff, and then that stuff becomes less valuable. Like you buy a bunch of new sports cars, right? You've just lost an immense amount of money by buying a brand new sports car and several. Let's say you buy several brand new sports cars. You are spending a lot of money, and as soon as you take possession of that, it has lost a significant portion of its value. And that's just how it is. Well, a lot of things people buy because they value them. But they have no intrinsic value after you buy it. They lose value. To be able to take money, inherited wealth, and then turn it into even greater wealth takes a lot of skill. You could say, like, well, he inherited $1 million when his father died. Most people would turn that into, I'm broke again 10 years later. They're not going to turn $1 million into $10 million. Most people couldn't do it, can't do it. That's why people who win the lottery don't become billionaires, you know, after they win the lottery. They're like, well, I won the lottery. You know, you never hear like, what's the secret of your success? How'd you get to be so successful in business? Well, first I won the lottery. Then I had a steady stream of capital. And so I started making investments. And then my wealth just kept growing from there. It was easy. Most people don't know what to do with money. You give a 20-year-old money, I almost guarantee, unless they're extremely exceptional, they don't know what to do with it. They don't know what to do with it. I don't know that I know what to do with it. For me, making money is about working. I wouldn't know how to make money. I wouldn't understand it at all. I like to, you know, if I have money, I want to build the world around me, which means I'm investing in a different kind of investment, not necessarily a profitable one. So Isaac is 40 years old, and he understands enough of the world to be able to manage the wealth he's about to inherit. And he's given a wife. What does it say? She was a virgin and neither had any man lain with her. That means she was young. She was a virgin meant she was young enough that she could be presumed to have been virginal, a maiden. You know, anywhere from, you know, 15 to 20 or maybe 14 to 20, you know, in that range. And some people in modern time, we would say, oh, well, that's not cool. I mean, down in Alabama recently, a guy who showed interest in girls of that age got thumped in an election because people don't like that. And in our modern society, that's culturally the way things have developed. But you got to understand, at this time, it makes a lot of sense because a man has to establish himself so that he can protect a wife and protect his family. So by the time, you know, he might be 40 before he's ready to have a family. Women in general, by the time they're 40, it's like their last shot at having a family. If a woman waits till she's 40 to have a family, there's a high probability that she's not even going to get one. In the modern age, we have fertility treatments. They have all kinds of things. But in the world that Isaac lives in, it makes neither sense for him nor for the maid to marry someone of their same age. Girls, it is best they get started as soon as possible because there can be miscarriages. There can be all kinds of things. You have a certain amount of fertile period in your life in which you can bear children, which is the most important and fulfilling thing a woman can do in her life is to bring forth children. And when women pursue the things that men pursue, very frequently they're unhappy. It's rare that a woman is happy and content living a man's life. It's rare that a man is happy and content living a man's life, but that's neither here nor there. So, again, it's easy to judge Abraham. It's easy to judge Isaac with our modern sensibilities. But you got to understand the societies in which they live. They didn't live in our society in which children are expected at 18. Or maybe 20, 21, males are expected to already be well on the road to success. But don't judge Isaac and his generations because of the forces they had to deal with. He wasn't ready before 40. And at 40, she'd be past her prime. So anyways, getting back to the issue at hand here. The children are struggling within her. She feels this roiling fight going on in her womb. And she says, she questions this. If it's like this, why? You know, if God is blessing me, why is it so, you know, she was troubled by this. That's what I take away from it. I'm not sure if there's anything more than that to say about it. So she went to inquire of God, of the Lord, and he tells that there are two nations, two manner of people, that they are a people who will be in conflict, two very different types of people. One is going to be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. And so, it's going to appear at first that the elder is the stronger. I'm going to say that, I'm going to spoil it a little bit. Strength is measured in different ways. You know, a man can be physically stronger, as Esau will be over his brother Jacob. But there are other kinds of strengths. There's strength of character. And the question is, what does God value? Because I can tell you from when David was chosen to be king, what did it say? You know, look not on, he was looking at all the sons of Jesse, and he was saying, you know, don't look at how strong they look. Look at how muscular they seem to be. The Lord doesn't look on these things. The Lord looks on the heart. So verse 24 here says, and when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red all over like a hairy garment. It's a real hairy baby. I've seen this. I mean, not red, but I've seen some hairy babies. Some babies come out with full head of hair and their arms, they have like a fuzz all over them. So the first, the elder, comes out all red and hairy. I mean, what's more masculine than being just covered with hair? And they called his name Esau. Now, Esau means rough. And his nation was known as Edom, which means red. That's a lot like the word Adam, which means red. Esau, the rough guy. Covered with hair, like a hairy garment. So they called him hairy or rough. You know, that's almost like the thought. Here he comes, the boy. He's all, hey, we're going to call him Harry. Verse 26, and after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob, or Jacob in Hebrew. And Jacob means heel catcher. They see the babies and they name them according to what they see. It's kind of romantic, you know? And instead of picking out your name way ahead of time, you just wait till the baby's born and you just say the first thing that comes in your mind. And you're like, okay, we'll call this guy Rough. Rough guy. And this one, Heel Grabber. That's how it was. Heel Grabber. Because they were wrestling. And apparently, Esau won. But Jacob did not let go of his heel. He was still hanging on. He was still fighting. That's the imagery. That's what we're made to understand. Jacob may have been defeated, but he is still fighting. He may have been physically overcome, but he hasn't given up. Esau came out first. He's the firstborn. He is in line to inherit the promise. Because generally, firstborn sons inherit. Now, if you know anything about the Bible, you know that Jacob is going to inherit. So there we have a conflict now. Firstborn son, Esau. But God has already said the elder shall serve the younger. One's going to be stronger than the other. Notice it says the elder shall serve the younger. One's going to be stronger than the other. Verse 27, and the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field. And Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. It's a little deceitful in the King James. I don't mean they meant to deceive us, but the translation, I don't know if in Old English plain had a little different meaning. I mean, we can say of someone, he's a plain-spoken, down-to-earth kind of person. And that kind of goes towards what this means. But this word means complete. in the moral sense, like a morally put together person. He's put together in a moral way. He's got standards, and he's, complete doesn't necessarily mean righteous, like in the absolute sense. God will regard him as righteous, but he is, when I say, I guess my hands are starting to make like a sphere, and I think almost like complete as in well-rounded. He is not just some hunter. And what's wrong with hunting? Nothing. But here's the thing. This is what it says of Esau. You understand, they're not living in a hunter-gatherer society. They have flocks and fields and stuff like that. So Esau is a hunter for sport. Well, Paul, I don't think hunting is a sport. Oh, it's one of the oldest. The only one that may be older is man versus man combat, wrestling or boxing or something like that. The sport of wrestling, of a man fighting another man for fun, as opposed to a deadly, serious endeavor. When we're talking about something that's deadly serious, that's not a sport. And when you're hunting to survive, that's not a sport either. But as soon as you are doing something, and it's, you don't need to do it. Like, I'm just hunting because I like hunting. I'm just wrestling because I like wrestling. Now it's a sport. I'm just doing it for fun. Esau was off hunting. He's a man of the field. He's off in the field, but he didn't need to be. You know what I'm saying? This is something he is characterized by, his pleasure seeking. He's a pleasure seeker. Hunting is fun. He likes to go out and hunt, and he likes to go in the field, and he can track animals. He can sniff the ground and know, what recently defecated in the area. He's just really familiar with the wild and the things of that, and he's way into that kind of rough living style. And doubtless he's a physically imposing and strong man. He's stronger than Jacob. Jacob just dwells in tent. He doesn't go out in the field and hunt and do cool stuff like that. He's just hanging around in the tent doing who knows what. To me, it implies something like he was administering affairs. He dwelt in tents. He was administering things. He was in the tent. People are outside working. He's in the tent. He's figuring the figures. He is calculating. I mean, Jacob shows himself to be very calculating and very shrewd in later chapters. He's very shrewd, very calculating. And not only that, he is a plain man. I mean, he is a morally upright, a morally put together guy. He's put together on a moral basis. He thinks a lot about what's right and wrong, whereas Esau thinks a lot about, when can I go hunting next? Esau is always seeking pleasure. Jacob is always seeking the greater good. That's how I look at it. The one is stronger than the other. And this is true of both of them, but in different ways. Esau is physically stronger than Jacob, and Jacob is morally stronger than Esau. So that's the difference between the two sons. Two totally different kind of guys. And then we have here the plot thickens. Verse 29. Oh, let's go back. We skipped verse 28. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison. In Hebrew, actually, it says he did eat of his hunting. And the King James translators put this word venison in there because it is a figure of speech that means that which is produced by hunting. He ate of the game he caught. So Isaac loves Esau, who brings in all that meat. He really enjoys the game. But Rebekah loved Jacob. It's very easy for a father, depending on his own characteristics. Maybe Isaac was more like Jacob. We don't know a lot about Isaac's personality, per se. Maybe he wasn't a hunter, but his son was. And that may have been very charming to him. The son is so strong, and you feel like, this is what came out of me, this strong hunting man. And he looks on the positive aspects of that, because there are positive aspects. It's good to be someone who is ready to play and have fun, And Esau is not a terrible person by any means. He's not horrible. But he is a profane person. And that's what, because that's what it says in the New Testament. He was a profane person. And it says God hated him. Not that all his characteristics are necessarily bad. It wasn't because of his characteristics. God hates him because God hates him. When they were in the womb, neither having done any good or evil, God hated Esau and loved Jacob. All right, it's not just because he was a hunter. It's because he was Esau. He was hateful. And this coming up passage will kind of tell you. I almost skipped, but Rebecca loved Jacob. Rebecca, her heart was Jacob. She loved Jacob in his ways. Different kind of man. Maybe Jacob was more like his father. Maybe his father was blind to it. In fact, Isaac goes blind. He is blind. For the purposes of his sons, he is blind to which one deserves the blessing. And sometimes that happens. Fathers can be blind, blinded by love. You know? You may have a son and he's not worth anything, but you love him anyways. And you can't fault the father for loving his sons. But God will distinguish one from the other in the end. I mean, whatever we do, God's going to distinguish them. God's going to separate them. Verse 29, and Jacob sowed pottage. And Esau came from the field, and he was faint. He sowed pottage. What, was he laying out grass? What, was he getting it all wet? Because sod, I think of sodden, like when something becomes very wet, it is sodden. Or I think of the sod on the grass. But this is the Old English, and it comes from the verb to seethe. To seethe and to sod. And it means to boil. So he boiled pottage. What is pottage? It's just food in a pot. Stew, soup. I think of it as stew. And it's described as, here, well, it says in verse 30, Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name called Edom. His nation became known after the name of Edom, which means red. And he was also, remember, he was hairy and red when he came out. So he had a nickname, is the way I look at it. He saw that red pottage, probably red lentils. It would be very common in this part of the world, lentil soup. He sees the red pottage. You know, his nickname, he's all red and hairy. They call him Rough. That was maybe his dad's doing. But everyone else calls him Red. Rough Red. Red and hairy. So he was called Red based on several things. One, his birth. Two, his fondness for red lentils. 31, and Jacob said, sell me this day thy birthright. Oh, Jacob. Do you think Jacob maybe had thought this out ahead of time? Oh, that's very possible. Very possible. His brother is just a gamesman running around hunting, man of the field. You know, that cliche character of robust manhood. Not necessarily a bad sort. But is that where God's blessing to all the nations is going to come? That sort of person? Well, Jacob knows about the birthright. He wants it. Esau was firstborn. Jacob wants his birthright. He also knows his brother, what he likes. He's weak for red lentils. Okay. I'll make him red lentils. 32. And Esau said, behold, I am at the point to die. And what profit shall this birthright do to me? He makes a joke about it. That's what he's, what, you understand. It's not that he's serious even. He's like, ha, what do I need with a birthright? I'm going to die. Sure. You know, he's light. He doesn't even consider it. He's not seriously considering giving up his birthright. He wants to eat, and his brother says, sell me your birthright. And he's like, what do I need with a birthright? Let me have something to eat. It's nothing. And then so Jacob says, in verse 33, swear to me this day. I swear it. And he sold his birthright to Jacob. He's profane. He doesn't care about it. You know, I was going to use an idiom. He doesn't give a bleep. You know, he does not give a bleep about his birthright. He's hungry. He wants to eat right now. He wants to go hunt and he wants to kill and eat. And I bet he's a lot of fun on the weekends. Esau. He's a profane man. Profane people are often very fun to be around. But Esau is an example. Profane men do not inherit. They do not inherit. They do not. You know, lay aside that profanity and get serious about God. You know, there are some people in this life who all they pursue are their pleasures and their sport and their, you know, their football, their whatever, you know. That's all they care about. That's the most important thing to them. You're going to die. And there's going to be nothing for you. And, you know, and what are you going to say then? Oh, what do I need with the Lord? I've got the sports package on ESPN. I got the NFL package. I got the NBA package. I got all the packages. I got all the games. I got all my favorite teams. I just can't wait to get home on the weekend and just sit and watch sports all weekend. It's the best ever. It's hours and hours and hours. I mean, I used to enjoy watching sports. Ever since I moved out to the country, though, I didn't get cable and we don't have local TV. And at the time, all I had was dial-up internet. So I was mostly just, you know, renting DVDs from the video store or the library. And other than that, we didn't get broadcast. Some people say, well, I never have a TV. I'm not like that. We have TVs. I just control what goes on them. I don't just tune into the broadcast. I'm glad. I tuned out it right at the perfect time before the broadcast television became so wickedly corrupt. I mean, just short of whatever, you know, I don't know. I can't even really say. I have inklings of the kind of things they broadcast. I like network television. I've heard tell of the kind of programming. But I can't say from first-hand experience. There's a place for recreation and for fun. I love to have fun. But life is mostly toil. And there's a lot of suffering in life. We got to take it up. We got to work. The Lord Jesus took up his cross and he bore it. We also need to take up our burdens and bear it. We can't be just la 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 off in fun land doing the things we love and only the things we love and feeding ourselves only the things we desire and like taking no heed. Yeah, I don't care one. What do I need with a birthright? What do I need with Jesus? I've got Jesus. I don't need to give attention to it. I don't need to be attentive to the salvation which God has wrought. It's already wrought. Right now, what I need is some pottage. Right now, what I need is some sport. I'm tired. So Jacob steals away his brother's birthright. I was kind of wondering what word I would use there. Steals it away. Fair and square, but he knows his brother. He's taking advantage of him. He is. He's taking advantage of his brother, his weaknesses. Because he wants that birthright so bad, he is willing to trick his brother. There's no trick. There's no trick. You know what I mean? Some people say Jacob tricks his brother. No trick. He does trick his father a bit. But the thing is, he earned the birthright. Isaac is not consenting to it. Well, Esau gave it up. And we'll read about that. We'll read about that. But the thing we take from this, as it is written in the New Testament, Esau was a profane person. What does profane mean? It's, I believe that's Latin. Yeah. Pro means like away from or out from, you know, it projects away. We usually think of it like for, like, I'm pro this or pro that. But like, if you know the difference between prescribe and proscribe. Proscribe is that which is forbidden. And so the idea of profane, because remember, you don't always, you know, words are not necessarily intelligible as parts. But anyways, profane means away from, the fane, which means like the holy place, the temple. It means things which are far from God, right, for the Christian mind, for the biblical perspective. Profane is that which is far from that which is holy. Everything that is profane is away from God. Less, I mean, it's not necessarily wicked per se. You know what I'm saying? No, but really it's anything outside. Like my shoes that walk on the ground are profane. They would be something that you could not bring into the Holy of Holies, where God is. And you take off your shoes as a sign of respect. There are things that are outside that would be profane. Or let's say those things are outside of the circle of holiness, of that which is part of the temple, part of the holy things. And so Esau is a profane person. His mind is very separated from the holy things of God and from the promises of God and from all the things of God. He is profane. His mind is far from those things. That's why he's like, I'm about ready to die. What is this birthright going to do for me? Give me some soup. Verse 34. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink, and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. He despised his birthright. Did he hate his birthright? I hate my birthright. No. It was by comparison. Because he was willing to swear and to trade it away for one meal. It's not that he hated it, is he didn't value it properly. He didn't value the things of God. As I says, Jacob, he was a perfect man, or complete, morally put together, and he dwelt in tents. He minded the things of God. You know how I can tell? Because he wants to get this birthright away from Esau. He wants the birthright away from Esau because he knows his brother. He knows he's unworthy of it. And Esau goes and proves it. I mean, Esau could have proved otherwise by being offended. My birthright for soup? Are you out of your mind? Do you understand that God made a promise to our father Abraham, our grandfather? They don't have a word for grandfather. They would just say Father Abraham. Forefather. You know that God gave a promise? And then that for our father Isaac would be born a nation through whom all the nations of the world be blessed, and you think I want to give that up for soup? He could have proved it. I'm not a profane person. My birthright is valuable to me. And so does Christ. How valuable is Christ to you? You've been born again, begotten of a spiritual seed. How valuable is that to you? What would you trade that away for? If I deny Christ, what will you give me? I'll spare your life. Oh, that's a tough choice. My life or Christ? Okay. Let's not get right to death. Let's see just how invaluable Christ is to you. How about some tobacco? Would you sell out Christ for tobacco? Would you sell out your belief in doing the right thing? Would you sell out, how about this? Would you sell out your brother for some tobacco? I don't know why I picked on tobacco, I guess. I used to smoke. And I know how powerful that can be. And I read, you know, Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago. And men would sell each other out for cigarettes. For a little extra food. They'd snitch on each other. They'd sell each other out. At what price would you sacrifice your integrity? Yeah, I'm just bringing this down because we don't all have some birthright like Esau. We got a birthright in Christ. We've been born again, begotten of a spiritual seed, right? Into a holy priesthood. We have this holy inheritance, which is for us. And there are things in the forces in the world that would come and try to persuade you to treat it as an unclean thing, to despise what you have by birthright, by faith in Christ, what you have obtained. There are other things in the world you can have right now. Right now, you can gratify yourself in the world if you would just compromise when it comes to the righteousness of God, which God has taught. If you compromise that, you can have instantaneous pleasure. Just become a profane person. And I say that because I want to bring it down to the lowest levels, so that we be not like Esau, profane. You know, it's what it says in Hebrews chapter 12. Look at Hebrews chapter 12, let's start with 11. I'm just going to read these as a thought to close out the study. Well, let's read it from verse 10. let's read it from verse 9. Let's read it from verse 7. No, I'm just kidding. But it's important. Let's start from verse 7. Actually, verse 6. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, correction, punishment, whatever. Not punishment, correction. Chastening, it's different. God dealeth with you as with sons. Because when God chastens us, it is not to punish us like an enemy, but rather to help us walk the right way as a son. For what son is he whom the father chasteneth not? I'll tell you what kind of son. He's a son his father hates. Because your children are going to do things you don't like. And if you allow that, you're going to hate them. You should never let your children do things that will make you hate them or other people around them hate them. It's a real crippling way to send a child off into life. And the Lord corrects us so that we will be acceptable to him. Not just through grace, but through just that our behavior would become better. He's going to mold us. It's part of the deal. He saves us, and then we submit to being shaped by him as a consequence of salvation. Verse 8, but if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. If you're not corrected, if God doesn't do anything about your behavior, then you're a bastard. You're not a son. He doesn't even care about you. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh, which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? Look, we reverence our fathers. Any man who had a father who justly corrected him and disciplined him, there's a lot of respect in that. I'm not talking about abusive people who just hit kids for no reason or for bad reasons. There's always reasons. I'm talking about reasoned and good correction, which brings behavior into a sphere where it is acceptable not only to the family, but to the world at large. And it gives the child a leg up and a benefit socially, both at home and wherever they may go. They become the kind of people that other people like to be around because their behavior is socially acceptable. 10. For they verily for a few days chasten us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. I correct my parents so that, I mean, I correct my children so that they behave in a way that pleases me. That is my primary motivation. I want to have children that I do not go crazy around. I don't want to be miserable in my life. And having well-behaved kids in my house is important. I've always said that. I can't determine how their life is going to turn out. I'm not God. All I can determine is whether or not I'm going to like them in my house and whether I'm going to want to have these people around. So I correct them in order that they would be pleasing to me. God does it not merely for his pleasure, but for our profit. Because he knows what can profit us. Because it is not merely a temporary thing so that while we're children, we are tolerable. But it is because he intends to bring us forever into his household. And that we might partake of his holiness, of the specialness which God possesses, which makes him above and beyond all humanity. Now no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Righteousness brings about peace. It is a peaceable fruit. Righteous men have peace when we're exercised by the chastening of God or by our parents or whatever. Wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight the paths of your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. What he's saying is, you know, make way, you know, go the right path. Don't allow your infirmities and your faults to take you out of the way, but rather seek to be healed so that you can walk straight, which is an analogy for walking the proper, moral, upright path. 14, follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. So it's about peace and holiness. That's important when you consider Esau. 15, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For you know how that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. For you are not come to the mount that might be touched, and that burned with fire, nor unto blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet, and the voice of words, which voice they that heard entreated that the word should not be spoken to them any more. I'm not going to go on because it just keeps going and going and going. Esau was profane. He did not value holiness. And he was a man. So by the time, and as we're going to see in the following chapter, that he is going to seek to receive the blessing, and he's going to be rejected because the blessing has passed. And it will be apparent when we cover that in just a few weeks. This is Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Strangini. Thank you for joining me in this study. You can find all my studies online at oraclesofgod.org. They can also be downloaded through other places like torrent sites, BitTorrent. Thank you for joining me in this study. I look forward to studying with you again very soon.